I'm Jim Watson. We're going to talk today about cryptography, and this is my first panel, and I just really didn't like sitting up here, and so I thought I would kind of wander around a little bit, and I'll take questions throughout this thing, and maybe we'll have some time at the end if you want to talk about, you know, things that aren't directly on topic. If you have questions, maybe we'll do like Phil Donahue. Does anybody remember Phil Donahue?
Yeah.
And I'll just walk up and point the mic in your face. And we'll try that, see how it works. I'm curious, how many of you have, this is your first Dragon Con?
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. You do know there's like a beauty pageant going on right now, right? That you all could have been in instead of this. Yeah. My money's on the Orion slave girls. I don't know about you guys. It's interesting how this panel came to be. I have a CISSP. That's a Certified Information System Security Professional certification. And one of the things that I do occasionally is that I teach other people who want to get their CISSP about cryptography. And so I have this this PowerPoint deck, and I sent an email to Scott, you know, who runs this track, and I said, do you have any interest in having a little cryptography talk? And he said no. Then about a month or so after that, he said, well, are you still interested in doing that cryptography thing? And I said, yeah. And then I said, well, can you get me some free tickets? And he said no. And I said, well, okay, I'm coming anyway. So we'll go ahead and get into this. Here's my agenda. I was in the Air Force, you know, many, many years ago. And one of the things that they taught us in NCO leadership school was when you're given a presentation, you tell people what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. So here's what we're doing. We'll talk a little bit about me. I don't like doing that part, but you know, I figure you guys, this session's costing you $1.50. So, I want to make sure you feel like you're getting $1.50 out of it. Well, we'll do a quick overview. You got a question?
How are you calculating that
$1.50? Hang on. Into the mic. Oh, come forward though, because of the.
How are you calculating that $1.50?
I don't know. it just sounded good.
Divide the membership by the total number of potential sessions.
There you go. Yeah. So what we're going to talk about today are we're going to go over ciphers and the different kinds of ciphers, symmetric encryption. We're going to talk quite a bit about hashing because it's been in the news a lot lately, and I think maybe you guys might find that kind of interesting. We're going to talk about key exchange and why that's important and how we do that. And then we'll wrap up by talking about asymmetric encryption. So I've been doing software development since 1983. And I got into information security in the 90s. I got into cryptography about 10 years ago. And you know, that's pretty much about me. I got my CISSP about 2 years ago, and for those who don't know anything about the CISSP, it's a certification for security professionals, and it covers 10 domains, and cryptography is just one. So I usually ask people what they think cryptography is, but I found that a lot of people don't know. So what I'm going to do is let's talk about the first cryptographic system you guys were ever exposed to. And you cracked it about 2 years later. And it's I would be willing to bet that it's the oldest encryption system in continuous use. And do we have any moms in here? Well, they know about the mom cipher. Do you guys know what the mom cipher is? You spell things, right? So what you're doing is you're taking the sounds that your children would recognize and you're substituting the sounds of letters, right? So that's an example of a cipher. Say the word ice cream is the plain text. You run it through the MOM cipher, and you get ICECREAM. And the kid in the back seat, he has no idea what that means. So that's the first example. Here's another example. A few years after that, after you cracked the MOM cipher, you used a cipher on the playground to keep. Maybe you're in the second grade, and you wanted to keep the kids in the first grade from hearing what you were talking about. You guys have any idea what that cipher is?
Big Latin.
Big Latin, yeah, exactly. That's an example of a transposition cipher, and we'll talk more about those in a second. If you're taking the CISSP, this is all the stuff that you need to know about cryptography. Now, we're not going to hit all this stuff in here. We'll hit a lot of it, but it's a lot of material, and this is you when in a CISSP class when we get to cryptography. This is when people usually bail. it can be daunting, but we won't make this daunting. Let's talk about the transposition cipher. In a transposition cipher, what you're doing is you're taking the plain text, and you're moving the letters around. The oldest known cryptography device is called a Skiddly. That's the way Wikipedia has it pronounced. It sounds kind of odd to me, but we'll stick with the Wikipedia pronunciation. The Skiddly is from ancient Greece, 7th century BC. And the way the Skiddly works is you have a round shaft that you wrap a piece of cloth around, and you write a secret message on it, attack at dawn. Then you send that piece of cloth or whatever it happens to be with a messenger to your general, and he wraps it around his Skiddly. And he can read the message. Now, the way it works, you know, that if you just did that, if you just wrote out attack at dawn, and you unrolled the piece of cloth, it would be pretty obvious that it says A space space T space space. You know, you'd be able to read it. So what you do is on the Skiddly is you throw in some extra characters, and so it would look something like this. So you can get an idea how it works. And so with the Skiddly, the key, the thing that makes the Skiddly work is the diameter of the rod that you wrap the cloth around. Here's another example of a transposition cipher. I invented this one. I call it the Watt cipher. It's also called a route cipher. And what you would normally do to encode or decode this, you would arrange those encrypted words into a grid. And I've done that here. And we'll try, you guys can try to decrypt that. We'll leave it up on the screen at the end and see who can decrypt it. My wife decrypted it in about 15 seconds. So it's, you know, I'm probably not going to want to use that in anything I don't want her to know about. My wife's pretty smart, and she can beat me at chess about half the time. And the other thing she does is she saves me money by buying things. I haven't figured out how that works, but she's pretty good at it. Let's look at another kind of cipher, a substitution cipher. In a substitution cipher, this is something that, you know, a transposition cipher you may not be familiar with, but in a substitution cipher, what you're doing is you're replacing a character in the plain text with a different character. And so the oldest documented, I guess you'd say, substitution cipher is the Caesar cipher. And the way the Caesar cipher works is you basically replace each letter in the plain text with a letter three spaces down on the alphabet. So if we had a message from Caesar, it might look like that. So the L would translate into an I. Do you see how that would work? You just go back down the alphabet. And I decrypted it for you. Basically, Caesar's telling us he's not the salad dude. Another substitution cipher that you might be familiar with is Rote 13. Has anybody heard of Rote 13? If you did bulletin boards or whatever back in the day, and you used Rote 13. Rote 13 is like a Caesar cipher, only you move 13. So somebody here let's pretend somebody here just sent me this message. And to go 13 back from V would be too hard for me to do. And so there's a handy little command line utility called translate. It's available in Linux systems, and probably the Mac has it. And it's really handy. I'm just gonna echo in the message that I got, and I'm gonna tell it to, every time it finds an A, to replace it with an N, every time it finds a B, to replace it with an O, etc. And it's pretty handy. It does lots of other things, but it's handy for that kind of stuff. And the message is, I have the DragonCon crud. The cool thing about the Rote 13 is the exact same cipher decrypts the message. So if I do it again, if I push in, I have the DragonCon crud, and I use the same translate function, then I get the original encrypted message. Ciphers operate in a couple of different modes. They operate in chunks, so that as you feed in a plain text message, it will encrypt some predefined chunk at it, and then move on to the next chunk. We call that a block. Ciphers can also operate in a stream mode, and what they do in a stream mode, and this is kind of hard to understand, but they encrypt a bit at a time. And the way the stream cipher does that is it generates a string of random bits based on the key that you give it, and then exclusive ORs it with the message. So if you're not familiar with exclusive OR, here's how it works. That top line is the message. Remember, computers only work in binary anyway, right? And the bottom line there is the key stream that the cipher is generated. And when you do an exclusive OR, do you remember how that works? A 1 or a 1 is what? A 0, right? A 1 or a 0 is a 1. And of course, a 0 or a 0 is a 0. So so when you exclusive OR those two numbers, that's what you get. The neat thing about exclusive OR, kind of like Rote 13, is the same operation encrypts and decrypts. So if I take that same random string of bits and I exclusive OR it again, I get the original message. All right, now we're going to talk about symmetric encryption. And symmetric encryption takes a plain text message and a key and gives you an encrypted message called ciphertext. So I've got this file in my system called plain text, and it says, this is a test file. I'm not sure why I would encrypt this, but let's pretend that's important. And I'm going to use PGP. Anybody familiar with PGP? All right, so I'm using PGP, and I'm telling it I want to do a symmetric encryption. And I don't have to do this part, but I did because it kind of makes it look nicer on the screen. I told it to armor it. I'll show you what that means in a second. and I gave it the name of the file that I want to encrypt. So it's going to ask me for a password or a key, and then it's going to ask me again and confirm that it got the right key, and that's it. That's all it does. So it's going to create this file called plaintext.asc. It looks like that. It doesn't look at all like this is a test file. Now, it also puts some boilerplate around, but I cut that out because it just takes up real estate on the slide and it's not really relevant to what we're talking about. If I want to unencrypt that, let's say I send that to somebody, and that person wants to unencrypt it, well, then they just use this command, give it the encrypted file, enter the passphrase that I encrypted it with, and they get back the original message. Now, there's lots of different symmetric encryption algorithms. Probably the best well-known is called DES, the Data Encryption Standard. And it became a standard in 1977, and it was pretty good as far as we know. It got cracked in 99. So what the federal government did, NIST in particular, is they decided it was time for a new encryption algorithm. So they had a contest, and they picked a new algorithm they call AES, and that came into effect in 2001. We talked about the different modes that ciphers can work in, but there's also different kind of attributes to those modes. So there's electronic code book, and that's kind of what you're most familiar with. That's what, when I was explaining how block encryption works, the cipher encrypts a block at a time, and each block is independent of the others. Now, can you think of why that might be a problem? Imagine if you had a big message, and each block was encrypted with the same key and produced, you know, an encrypted result. If you can unencrypt one block, then you can unencrypt the whole message. So to kind of counter that line of attack, they came up with cipher block chaining. And in cipher block chaining, basically the output of each preceding block becomes the key for the next block. And in this way, it makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to unencrypt a single block and therefore discover the key. Now, there's tons of symmetric encryption algorithms. The ones I've listed here are the ones that you need to know for the CISSP exam, but I'm going to show you my favorite one. Oops, yeah. This is my favorite encryption algorithm because it's tiny, and it fits on a screen and people can see it. I first used this algorithm. That's quite a long time ago. I implemented it as an extended store procedure in SQL Server because we needed to encrypt something, and this was back before you could get encryption out of the box in SQL Server. Now you can get encryption in databases, you know, for free. You can get MySQL, you know, has AES encryption right in it. What I want you to see in this tiny algorithm is, one, how small it is, and two, it's just using arithmetic. So there's some bit shifts, going on here, but it's really doing arithmetic. And if you look at this is the encoding algorithm. If you look at the decoding algorithm, you can see it's doing exactly the same thing. It's doing the bit shifts, but it's doing a subtraction. So the algorithm is very simple, and it's got implementations in almost any language. Yeah, go ahead.
Is all this encryption for business? Is this like for credit card transactions, for Lockheed not to let Boeing know what the wingspan is on the new passenger jet, or what's the purpose of this type of encryption?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it so the purpose of encryption is to keep something secret. So, well, it can be used for anything. If you have some information that you think is important enough that you don't want anybody to see it, then you're going to want to encrypt it. And so, yeah, businesses use it. Now, I use this particular algorithm to encrypt credit cards. It was later found to be weak, and so we changed to AES. Does anybody know what T stands for?
You said you found it to be weak. What was the process of finding the weakness?
Well, I'm not a cryptanalysis guy, so I didn't personally find it to be weak, but somebody published a paper that said there was a way to derive a key through a brute force attack. And so what happened is the credit card industry, they have standard security procedures that you're supposed to use if you handle credit card data. It's called PCI DSS. And in PCI DSS, they basically said you can't use T. So that's why we changed. But anybody have any idea what T stands for? The tiny encryption algorithm. See, this cryptography stuff's not hard. Let's talk about hashing. Hashing's been in the news a lot. I'm going to hash this string called password, and I'm going to use the MD5 encryption algorithm, hashing algorithm, and that's what I get. There's nothing, you know, not a big deal. Now I want to hash password 1. This is hexadecimal, yes. Yes. Somebody just asked me if this was hexadecimal. Yes, it is. So now I want to hash password 1. So think for a minute before I show you what the hash of password 1 looks like. What do you kind of expect the hash to look like? See, you may have expected it to look almost like the hash for password, but you can see it's not at all like the hash for password. What else do you notice about the hash?
It's not any longer.
It's not any longer, that's right. It doesn't, and in actuality, it doesn't matter how big the string is that we pass to MD5, it always gives us back the same length. I got a question back here.
So you were saying regardless of the string length, it will never overflow for MD5?
Now, you can have some collisions with MD5, and what I mean by collision is you could have two different strings that hash to the same value. That's an issue, but it's rare. So as we saw, MD5 hashes everything to be 128 bits in length. But it's been broken for a few years now, and as anybody in here do software development? Okay. If you're using MD5, you should have stopped years ago. It's kind of weak. So the cryptography community came up with some more algorithms, SHA-1, SHA-2. And in SHA-1, you have 160 bits no matter what you put in. You could run every bit on your hard disk into these hashing algorithms, and you'll only get 128 bits or 160 bits, or in the case of SHA-2, 256, or whichever algorithm you choose to use. But SHA-2's got some issues, and so the government, again, they have a competition underway to pick a new standard algorithm called SHA-3. This is probably a good point in time to talk about Kirchhoff. So there's this guy named Kirchhoff, and he came up with a principle that's called Kirchhoff's principle. And what it says is, you know, you remember I showed you, let's go back, I showed you the code for this encryption algorithm. I didn't write that code. I just lifted it from the paper that, the guys used when they wrote about that. Now, I could get the code and show you the code for any of these algorithms. And that may surprise you, but Kirchhoff says that the algorithms should be publicly available. And the reason for that is, if they're publicly available, then we can find weaknesses in the algorithms and fix them. And so the only part that matters in an encryption system is not the algorithm, it's the key. Let's get back to where I was. Yeah. All right, so imagine if you got a question?
This may be...
Come forward so they don't get the feedback.
Here?
Come forward.
Okay. This may be a silly question, but how do you secure the key? If the key gets out, then aren't you still basically screwed?
Yes. But we're going to talk about key management a little bit later. But your point is valid. If your key gets out, if you leave it on a yellow sticky on your monitor, you know, that's bad. Yeah, people do that. Well, imagine if you had an email message that was important. You received an email message from someone, and appended to the email message was an encrypted version of that message. And you knew the key that the person used to encrypt that appendix to the message. So what would you know? If you get this message from somebody, then you'll encrypt the message, the plain text part, using the same encryption algorithm they did and the same key, and you'll have two encrypted strings. And if those strings match, then you know two things. You know, one, that the person who sent it to you is the person you think sent it to you, assuming that the key hasn't been compromised. And you also know that the plain text part of the message has not been altered in transit. So we call that a message authentication code. And some smart guy figured out, well, wait a minute, the message authentication codes can get really big. And somebody said, well, wait a minute, we have these algorithms that no matter what you feed into them, you get the same size string. Why don't we use those for message authentication codes? And that's where HMAX come from. So an HMAC is just, the H is for hash. Okay. So let's talk about hashes in the news. How many people have a LinkedIn account? Did anybody get an email from LinkedIn about their password being compromised? Okay. This happened back in June, I think. So what happened is the hacker somehow got a hold of LinkedIn's password file. It may have been in a table, and they may have used, you know, a SQL injection attack to get to it. You know, who knows? But they got the password file. Now, in the LinkedIn case, they got 6 million passwords. And what they were able to do is look up the hashed values and determine what string was used to create the hash. So this is why we say that MD5 is broken or weak. It's because it's too easy to generate the hash values. So given enough time, hackers can just generate all possible passwords. And yeah, you got a question.
So is MD5 considered it just because the length of time it takes the computer to process it, they can generate the millions of hashtags quickly enough? Is that why it's broken, not because they found like an actual algorithm to crack it?
Yeah, that's right. So there's actually no way with a hash function to turn the hash value back into the plain text. It's just mathematically not possible. So when we say the hash is broken, what we mean is that that computing power has gotten to the point where it's easy to generate a large set of hash values, and basically the hackers just look up the value of your password. eHarmony, I won't ask if anybody's got an eHarmony account. They were similarly hacked. Last.fm, I honestly don't know what that is. It's what? Radio? Okay. I guess that makes sense, the FM. They were also hacked and their passwords got out. This was all, I think, just in June. And then about 18 months ago, Gawker got the same kind of hack and their passwords got exposed. So why does that matter? So if somebody gets your Last.fm password, does that really matter? I mean, if somebody's going to play your music or whatever, do you care? I mean, I guess that's how that works. The reason it matters to hackers is because, I'm not going to ask you guys to raise your hand, but I bet half the audience would raise their hand if I ask you how many times you reuse your password on different sites. So what the hackers did is, when they got their LinkedIn passwords or their Last.fm passwords or whatever, then they went to Gmail and they went to Bank of America and, you know, any place they could think of, and tried to log into your account. So that's why this matters. So yeah.
I feel like I'm at a literature conference. I'm about to ask about Go Dog Go, but I'm still trying to think about when you have the hash that everything has the same number of characters. In a very simple way, in my mind, I'm thinking like if you're trying to factor 48. How does the computer know that whether it's 16 times 3 is 24 times 2, 8 times 6, or whatever?
I think the best way to think about a hash function is to think about an encryption algorithm that your plain text is passed through and only the last chunk is kept. Does that help? That's not, you know, actually the way they work, but I think that's a good way to think about it. So what can you do about it? Well, yep, I got a question.
Did any of these companies salt their records?
Did they solve the
salt the passwords before?
Salt. Oh yes, we're gonna talk about salt in a second. Yeah, that's a good question. That's the answer to the question, what can we do about it? So as software developers, we can kind of make it hard for hackers if we do something called a salt. And in a salt, what we're going to do is generate a random string and append it to your password and then hash those together. And basically what we're doing then is making a short password long and increasing the time it would take for hackers to generate the tables they need to look up your password. Another thing we can do as developers is we can use a slower hash algorithm. That may not make sense since, you know, in computers we generally want to do things as fast as we can, but if you think about how password lookups work, so when you sign into LinkedIn, your password goes to their server, they hash it, and then they look to see if the hash value that they just calculated matches the hash they have in the database. So they're only doing one hash calculation at the time that you're logging in. So the speed of that operation doesn't really matter. So some of the newer hash algorithms are slow, which is good, because bcrypt is a good example of that. So if you've hashed your passwords with bcrypt, then hackers have to use bcrypt to generate their tables, and it will take them a long time to do that. So that's what, you know, that's a solution, that's a technical solution to the hashing problem. But there's a better solution. The most obvious one is not to reuse your passwords. And but that's hard, right? Because passwords have to be complex, or else you're going to forget.
How common might it be in the cracker world to take the name of the service and somehow or other include that in one of the tries they're making?
I'm not sure about that exact approach, but what hackers have learned from all these database breaches is that they've learned that people tend to use the same passwords. So, you know, what I mean is there aren't that many different passwords in use. And so the hackers have learned they have a dictionary of common passwords, and that's the first thing they'll try when they get a hold of a hash table. So it's hard to remember complex passwords. So what you need to come up with a method that works for you without putting them on a yellow sticky, so that you can somehow identify that my LinkedIn password is different from my eHarmony password. It's one of those things. It's hard to do, but you have to. Now, some people advocate using a password generation program. I'm not a big fan of those. The password generator will generate a really complex password for you, and then store it on, you know, maybe on a key fob or maybe on a server. But if the key fob or the server gets compromised, then all your passwords get compromised. That's not a good way to go. All right, so you asked me earlier about keys. So this is a good point where I need some volunteers. So is anybody named Alice? How about Bob? We have any Bobs in here? Don't worry, I won't make you say anything. I just want to point at you and talk about you. Would anybody like to be Alice?
I'll be Alice.
You'll be Alice. Okay, you're Alice. Would anybody like to be Bob? You can be Bob. And then I need an Eve. Would you like to be Eve? All right. So we got Alice and Bob and Eve. Help me come up with a scenario here. So usually we use Alice and Bob are communicating, and Eve is the bad person, and Eve is trying to eavesdrop and find out what the secrets are. So let's turn that around. Let's make Alice and Bob bad people. So you're okay with being a bad person? Okay. And so Eve's going to be a good guy. So let's come up with a scenario. What are Alice and Bob doing that they don't want Eve to know about?
Forging Dragon Con badges.
Forging Dragon Con badges. I like that. All right. So Alice and Bob, they've got their Dragon Con badge forging gang. Man, we need a name for that gang. Dragon Forge. That's good. I like it. So if it's just Alice and Bob, they have a key that they have to share between them, if we're talking about symmetric keys. So it's just one key. If they add somebody else to their gang, now they have two keys, right? If they add a third person, they have three keys that they all have to keep track of. Do you guys see how that works? It kind of makes sense. If they have four members of their gang, now they have six keys they have to keep track of. So what we get is this almost exponential growth in the number of keys you have to manage if you have a lot of people that need to communicate secretly. And so this little formula is something that you, if you were going to be a CISSP, you have to know. It tells you how many keys you have in your system based on the number of people in it. So you can see if you had 100 people in your system, you would have 100 times 99 divided by 2. That's a lot of keys. So the smart guys came up with something called public-private keys. And in a public-private key system, everybody has two keys. You have a public key that you share, and you have a private key that you don't. That's why it's called private. And if Alice wanted to send Bob, where's Bob? Back there. A message. Alice would encrypt that message with Bob's public key. She'd send the message to Bob, and Bob would decrypt it with his private key. Since there's only two keys in use, it makes key management a little easier. So, you know, there aren't that many keys floating around in the system. And the way these public-private keys work is it's based on a mathematical feature, I guess you'd say, called one-way functions. And one-way functions basically are functions that are easy to compute in one direction and, as far as we know, impossible to compute in the other. There's a special case of one-way functions called trapdoor functions. Trapdoor functions are hard to compute in one direction and easy in another if you know the trick. And I'm going to show you some examples of this. And we're going to, you know, you've probably heard about, if you can only factor really large numbers, you can defeat a lot of cryptographic systems. So we're going to talk about that kind of stuff in a few minutes. So there's another way besides physically exchanging keys to get a symmetric key communicated. And the most famous example of that is called Diffie-Hellman. And Diffie-Hellman uses a trapdoor function called discrete logarithms. And in Diffie-Hellman, we're not actually exchanging a key, we're just agreeing on a key. All right? So we got some math going on. I don't want to lose anybody. You guys remember modulo arithmetic? It's not hard. So 25 mod 7 is 4. That's because 25 divided by 7 is 3 with a remainder of 4. Okay. That means 5 plus 3 is 1. I know that doesn't make sense. 3 times 4 is 2. Everybody follow me? Alice and Bob, you need to pay attention, because I'm going to get you to do some math. So we say that if we take, if we list out all the integers from 1 to n minus 1 of some prime number, we call that a finite multiplicative group. And the reason we call it a group is because you can multiply any one of these numbers times any one of the other numbers, or even itself, and you'll get another number in the group. So if I multiply 5 times 6, what do I get? Anybody? You get 30, which is 2, because we're doing mod 7. Okay. So I told you Diffie-Hellman uses discrete logarithms. You guys remember discrete logarithms? You guys remember logarithms from school, right? So if k is equal to j raised to some x power, so 8 is 2 to the third. Everybody remembers that. The reverse is 3 is equal log to the base 2 of 8. So we say, and this is kind of complicated, and there won't be a test afterward, don't worry. If j belongs to a finite group, where p is a really big prime number, we'll talk about prime numbers a little bit later, then it's almost impossible to compute log j. And let's see why that matters. So we're going to have a little fun with Alice and Bob. All right. If we have two systems that are exchanging a key using Diffie-Hellman, then some of the steps that we're doing would be done by the systems. I have them in this example being done by Alice and Bob. But you know, just imagine that, that this is happening behind the scenes. So Alice has an app on her phone that communicates with Bob, and when they start the communication, then there's kind of like this handshake that goes on, and it establishes the key. So in the past, when I've done this little demonstration, I've let Alice pick the prime number, and that's turned out very bad. So I'm going to pick the prime number, and it's going to be 7. Okay. Then I had Alice list the finite multiplicative group, and that turned out really bad. So I'm going to do that. But keep in mind, like I said, it would be 2 apps doing this. It's going to happen almost instantaneously. It's not anything you have to think about. So the finite multiplicative group of 7 is going to be 1 through 6. Okay, easy enough. And we have to pick a small number that generates the group. This is kind of complicated what a generator is. Imagine that you take a member of that group and raise it to multiply it by itself over and over again. If that number that you picked generates every member of the group, then you call that a generator. So I used to have Alice pick the generator. I don't do that anymore either. So Alice, you're getting off pretty easy. So our number is going to be 3. That's going to be our generator. Let's go back and look at something. This is kind of interesting if you like the math. So here's our group, right? If you take 1 and multiply it by itself, no matter how many times you do that, you're only going to get 1. If you do 2, multiply it by itself, you're only going to get, I think, 1s and 2s. So you have to be careful about what number you pick. That's why I don't let Alice do it anymore. All right, so we've got our number 3. All right, Alice. Now, Eve, remember, Eve, you're listening in on this conversation, and you're trying to figure out what the key is. And all this up until now, this communication between Alice and Bob has happened in plain view of you. So there's no secrets here. But this is the only secret. So Alice, you have to pick an X from the group. Don't tell us what it is. Okay, just pick it. Pick it in your mind. Now you're gonna compute g to the x mod p. Good idea. You need something? You want a piece of paper?
No, I'm good.
Okay. All right. Tell us what g to the x mod p is.
2.
Where's Bob? All right, Bob. So you know. Here's what you know now. P is 7, G is 3, G to the X mod P is 2. And Eve, you know all that too. All right, Bob, you need to pick a Y from the list, 1 through 6. That's a secret. I don't need to know it. Now you're going to compute G to the Y mod P. Let me know when you got it. Get another member of your gang to help you out. Thank you. All right. So Bob's got his G to the Y. Alice has got her G to the X. Now, Alice, you're going to... His G to the Y is 2. So you're going to take your G to the Y. I'm sorry, this is wrong. No. G to the Y, the 2 that I just gave you from Bob, raise it to your secret X. Let me know when you got it. All right, Bob, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to take her G to the X that she communicated you earlier, which was 2, and you're going to raise it to your secret Y power. Okay. All right, now, Bob, show me with your fingers what your key is. Yeah. But we don't want Eve to know. No. Trying to figure out what that is, mod 7. Okay. What's yours? Yes, they do match. Yes. Okay. So their keys match. Now, Eve, can you tell us what the keys are? Well, there's only one key, but I mean, every bit. The only thing you don't know is the secret X and Y, but you've got all the other information. You ought to be able to figure out the key, you would think. So you were listening on the communication line, and you heard that the P is 7, that the G is 3, G to the X mod P was 2, G to the Y mod P was 2. The answer is, it's kind of a trick question. You can't figure it out. And it's because, do you guys remember when you raise something, G to the Y to the X, who can simplify this? This is, like ninth grade algebra.
X plus Y.
Nope.
The X plus Y.
No, it's not plus. It's G, G, Y, X, okay? And so this is G, X, Y. What do we know about X times Y and Y times X? They're the same, right? So that's the trick. This is the trick. This is the trap door. And it's why Diffie-Hellman works, and what makes it extremely hard to crack. Okay. So we talked a lot about symmetric encryption. And I introduced you to the key pairs, and so I want to show you how that works. The problem with the asymmetric encryption versus symmetric encryption is it's very slow. So typically, I'm going to show you an example where I'm encrypting a file with RSA encryption. Typically, you wouldn't do that. What you would do is you would use asymmetric encryption to encrypt a random key. It's that key that you would then transmit or use that to encrypt a larger, a file or, a large table value or whatever. We just talked about discrete algorithms. There's an encryption algorithm called El-Gamal. It uses discrete logarithms. But probably the most famous asymmetric algorithm is called RSA, and it relies on prime factorization. It's the one-way function of factorization that makes RSA secure. So we got more math content. Sorry about that. This is the last of the math. You guys remember the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, right? Any number is a product of some number of prime numbers. Okay, so in other words, so here's an example, 14, 2 times 7. Well, it turns out that if you know some number and P and Q are really large prime numbers, it's extremely time-consuming, if not impossible, to find P and Q. So that's what makes all this work. So RSA keys, then, they consist of this big number made by two prime numbers, and we call it a modulus. They also consist of a D and an E, the private exponent and the public exponent. D and E, I didn't put it on here because I felt like it was too confusing, but I'll talk about it a little bit. D and E are related to a third term that is related to P and Q. And so it turns out that if you can factor this, then you can find P and Q, but that also means you can find D. That's the key. Let me show you how this works. I'm going to use OpenSSL. OpenSSL is your friend when you're doing this kind of stuff. And I'm telling it to generate an RSA key. I want to call it my private key. And I want it to be 1,024 bits in length. In practice, you would not use a key that short, but I'm using it here because I can show it on the screen. So it does this. It tells me it's generated the thing. It made the modulus like we just talked about, and it told us what the public exponent was. Okay. And so now I've got my private key. That doesn't help me much. I need my public key. So again, OpenSSL. I want it to make an RSA key. Here's my input key. I want it to be a public key, and here's my output key. And that's all it does. Nothing to it. So let's look at what's in that private key. It's just an ASCII file. And so here's the key. Again, this is in hex. 1,024 bits number, a really big number. Public exponent is here. Here's my secret private exponent. So here's what makes this. This is a really simple algorithm. Once you get to this point, if you have some plain text and you want to encrypt it, you just raise it to the E power. And if you have some cipher text and you want to decrypt it, you just raise it to the D power. And remember, the private key is P, Q, and D, and N, and E. So it's pretty simple. I'll show you an example of that. I've got my plain text file again with the secret contents. And I'm going to use OpenSSL again. So I'm telling it I want to encrypt using this public key. Remember, you encrypt with a public key. You decrypt with a private key. I'm telling it to use this file and put it in this file. Now remember when I showed you guys the symmetric encryption, I armored the file. And what that meant is I turned the encrypted file into ASCII, which is kind of handy if you want to text it to somebody or IM it to somebody or email it to somebody. In this case, I didn't armor it, so you could see that that's really what it looks like when it's encrypted. It's kind of a bunch of gibberish. It's binary at this point. And if I want to decrypt that file, say I send this file to somebody, I use this command, decrypt. I'm using my private key. So in this case, what would have happened is Alice would have run this command using whose public key? Bob's? Who said Bob? Yes, you're right. Using Bob's public key. Then Bob gets the file. He runs this command using his own private key, and he gets the unencrypted file. All right, so we're pretty much done. And the conclusion I want you to take away from this is now you know enough to be dangerous. Because this cryptography stuff is kind of hard, and if you get it wrong, you don't know that you've gotten it wrong until you've been hacked. So, I mean, you know about ciphers and symmetric encryption and hashing, key exchange, and all kind of other stuff. And I hope it kind of demystified it a little bit for you guys. Here's the super secret message. And while I'm taking questions or whatever, you guys can try to see if you can unencrypt that.
I noticed when you were doing the Alice and Bob example. Okay, I noticed when you were doing the Alice and Bob example, you said it'd be impossible to find out what it was from the information given. But for that particular example, that's not true because the prime number chosen was so small. It's actually like really easy to decode it. What would be the smallest number that you could use that it would actually make it time-consuming?
Probably a number at least 1,024 bits, maybe. You know, and that sounds like a big number, but it's easy for a computer to do. So we had somebody decrypt it. And anybody else decrypt my super thing? Make me the sign if you decrypted it. Yeah. Okay. All right. Somebody's got it. So this is a route. This is a route cipher, and the way you decode it is you would have agreed with whoever you were communicating with that what you do is you start in the lower right hand corner and just follow a route. Follow the route through the grid. That's it. I didn't put footnotes in this. Instead, I just decided to do a works cited page. But if you want to know more information, this is probably the best book ever. And if you want to see the paper, Wheeler and Needham, they're the guys that wrote the paper on T, if you want to play with it. The nice thing about this book is it's got pseudocode for all kinds of algorithms you can play with. And if you get that book and read it, I'd encourage you to implement those algorithms in your language of choice. I got a question back here.
Do they do like double encryption, like a T and then RSA, or to encrypt the first?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they do. Remember, I told you that DES got cracked, and so the solution they came up with until they had a better algorithm was something called triple DES. What do you think triple DES means? It means you use DES three times. So yeah, so that is. A common approach to make things more secure. But you have to be careful. Remember what I told you about Rote 13? You know, that's a simple example, but if you double encrypt with Rote 13, you haven't accomplished much. Any other questions? Yeah, I got one back here.
Do you have any of the details on Moxie breaking CHAP? DEPCON?
No, I do not.
You had a question?
Yes. I know that Alex in the World War II had the Enigma machine. Is there such a utility that takes that example and basically you have different algorithms that you can choose on the fly, and basically it's really messed up with the signal, but it automates the process of using modern ciphers in that same way as the Enigma did in the 40s.
Well, if I understand your question, there are some Enigma apps that you can get. I'm pretty sure there's one for the iOS, and it simulates an Enigma machine. The interesting thing about an Enigma machine. Most people associate it was obviously used by the Germans in World War II, but that's not why it was invented. It was invented by a guy to secure financial transactions, and the Germans thought it was good enough to use, for their military. So that's where it came from. Any other questions? All right, I'll let y'all go. Enjoy the con.